Welcome to MGO Podcast 8.7. Ace is sick today, or at least he says he's sick. I think he's just watching the Rutgers touchdown over and over in a loop. He probably made a gif of it. That's just who he does. Don't normally do this, but I'd like to welcome in Ace of mgoblog.com. How you doing, Ace?
I'm doing all right, Brian.
Ace is at home today because he is sick as a dog, but he has consented to call in anyway because I made him.
Yeah, that's about how that went.
That's how we do. So we're going to preview the basketball team this year, and it is a year of turnover for Michigan. A couple of assistants have moved on to head coaching jobs elsewhere, and Michigan has imported Billy Donlin and Saadi Washington. Did I get Saadi right? Was that?
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, awesome. Billy Donlin in particular keeps telling people that he's not Michigan's defensive coordinator, but if you look at his Wright State stats, he's pretty much Michigan's defensive coordinator.
Yes. Also, John Beilein pretty much called him that during the presser right before the assistant coach media scrum. So there were very entertaining exchanges, mostly between Sam Webb and Billy Donlin, where Sam was like, this is what John was saying. This is what your boss is telling you. And Donlin kind of denying that that stuff was true anyway. It was enjoyable. but he is definitely the defensive coordinator.
And there's an interesting conflict I think we've brought up a couple times on the site where – you know, Michigan has infamously been one of the least fouling teams in the country during the entirety of John Beilein's reign. And at Wright State, his teams racked up fouls like they were on sale.
Yes.
And the middle ground there maybe would see Michigan move to a much more aggressive but foul-prone defense.
Yeah, and the way that Beilein was talking during his press conference, he acknowledged that they're going to have to think about auto bench in a different way. He even brought up the fact that, you know, some of the players that they were benching last year didn't even average 2 fouls per game, so that may not have been the correct course of action.
Praise Jesus.
Yeah, and that was in direct response to the question about how to kind of rectify the disparity between his style and Donlin's. So, that's a pretty good sign going forward. Because Donlin plays kind of it's not quite a pack line. He calls it a gap. They're not quite as packed down towards the basket, but it's still pretty help defense heavy, pretty intent on preventing penetration to the basket. There's no way they're going to be able to run that without being more aggressive. So,
didn't Zach Ervin say something alarming about how they spent like 200 to 300% more time on individual defense this offseason?
That was what John Beilein said.
Really?
500% on individual defense as opposed to evaluating players.
Okay.
yeah, so it seems like defense is just a bit more of an emphasis this year.
That will be a sea change for the program because, you know, the last 3 years they've been in the triple digits in KenPom on defense, which you should not be as a major school.
No, and Wright State has been, and where Donlin was previous to this, had a top 50 defense 2 years in a row. Had one off year where they were pretty bad and then bounced back to 71st last year.
And
his defense has been straight up better than Michigan's a couple times.
And that's with centers that are usually 6'6", if I recall correctly, right?
Yes, they have not had large players on that team.
I mean, this is a low major, Wright State is. And for Donlin to have the defensive results that he's had, that's about as impressive as you can get at that level of competition.
Yeah, it was kind of inexplicable that he was fired, even though his offenses have never been very good.
Yeah.
But they have a Brandon-esque athletic director situation over there, apparently. So
I do remember, like, the guy
to our benefit
on the Wright State beat out there when he got fired was just like, what are you doing? Like, who do you think you are? Like, they had one off year, but they were pretty consistently a 500 or above team that did decently in conference without being able to recruit anybody. So
yeah, they won 20 games at least each of the three of the last 4 years.
That's so crazy.
Yeah, firing that guy from Wright State. They were 13-5 in their conference last year.
That's what? What?
I don't get it either, but I'm happy it happened.
Yeah, and obviously this is something that hopefully will bridge the gap between Michigan's offense and their defense. But, you know, kind of the big flashing danger sign is center, which was yes. just a black hole defensively last year. Ricky Doyle has moved on, but we still have Andrew Dinal left, and I was not a big fan of his defense last year.
Mark Dinal.
Whatever. Mark Dinal. His brother was on my draft again team, so that's why I always think about him. Stick to sports. Nobody cares about your fantasy team.
In a different sport.
Yes. But so, I mean, I think the number one thing that Michigan fans want and hope and need to see this year is starting center Mo Wagner.
Yeah, and that's I think the huge thing, obviously, there is for him to just cut down on his foul rate. Because he was definitely Michigan's best center when he could stay on the floor last year and certainly looked that way towards the end of the season. But he had a habit of picking up pretty unnecessary fouls. Hopefully with Domlin in, one thing that will take away from that is hopefully Michigan won't be doing this crazy hard hedge with their center on high screens anymore. Because they would pick up a lot of cheap fouls on that, and it didn't seem like a particularly effective way to stop the pick and roll anyway.
Did Domlin say that, or is that just your hope?
That's my hope. He did not address that specifically. He was pretty, when asked specifically about things that Michigan was doing that he would change, he was both just, he said, you know, he hadn't had a chance to look over a ton from last year. They were only on practice three when media day occurred. And he was also just kind of treading lightly around questions that specifically related to how last year's team played defense, presumably because he was trying to be nice. So he didn't commit too much, but that's just, pack line teams don't play the pick and roll that way for the most part. So they're not committing players out that far about the perimeter. So I would assume that in a similar style defense, they're not going to do that.
The hard hedge is dead.
I hope so. I sincerely hope so. Cause with Matt Wagner, it's, if you take away those hard hedges where he's in a space where he might get those ticky tack fouls, and if he stops committing turnovers where he's kind of unnecessarily dribbling the ball on offense, he's definitely Michigan's best center if you take those two things away.
Well, and if you add 30 pounds, which hopefully he's on route to doing.
Yes, and at the open practice, one thing that really stood out at the open practice was their size, because the freshmen are huge. I don't know if they're going to play, but the Austin Davis and John Teske are both enormous. Teske's a legit 7 feet. He makes Dinal look small. And Wagner looked, he fit in with that group size-wise. So he definitely looks the part of a Big Ten center at this point.
And you know, when he did get on the field, not the field, I might have Harbaugh on the brain. Whenever he got on the court, I almost said ice as well. So I'm having a good day. Whenever he got on the court, last year, I mean, he performed, and it was, I mean, he got playing time late in the year, and it was like, where has this been guy been all year, sitting on the bench? And, you know, he kind of brings a Mitch McGarry vibe where he's able to create turnovers, get loose balls, and has that ability to finish with one hand with either hand. Like, he's really efficient if you get him underneath the basket in a way that Mark Dinal is not.
Yeah, he had some surprisingly good tough finishes, especially on a couple with tough catches on pick and rolls where you've got your momentum taking you out of bounds, and you still manage to convert layups off of those. And he also has the athleticism to put in some dunks that Mark Dinal is just not doing. So his ability to kind of finish through contact and finish around the rim, I mean, it's definitely, if Michigan's going to reach their potential, he's got to be the guy at center.
And then Mark Dinal is back. I mean, I'm hoping that he's a useful backup piece.
Yes.
He can shoot if he's on, and he can shoot from three. That kind of opens up some things for Michigan's offense that haven't been there since Beilein was at West Virginia. So a guy who I don't see getting a whole lot better, especially on the defensive end, just because he's not big enough and he's not quick enough to really cope.
Yeah. The athleticism isn't there at the toughness factor that you would like to kind of make up for that is not necessarily there. And Beilein...
That's very diplomatic.
Yeah, really. Beilein was, it was interesting because he was asked a couple times about, because, you know, Michigan's kind of done the thing where, like they did with Bielefeld, where they list him, even though he's taken a redshirt year, they're still listing him as a true senior. And when he was asked about that, Beilein basically said, we need, like, the couple good games we got out of him last year, we need 35 of those this year, and then we'll kind of reevaluate it. Like, he was really not committal.
Wow.
About that extra year. And I was a little surprised by that after Doyle's departure, but it did not seem like Beilein was very committed to bringing him back.
Well, they did bring
and
in
I
two,
think that says a lot.
They did bring in the two freshman posts. As you mentioned, Teske is a true 7-footer with long arms, and at the very least, he should be a functional shot blocker and rebounder, even as a freshman. I think he's going to get playing time just because he'll be useful.
And to be honest, Davis looks like the more, I mean, obviously very limited time of seeing them at this open practice in limited situations. But in terms of the way that Beilein has talked about the two and how they looked, Davis is actually, I think, more likely to see the court immediately.
Really?
Teske's a little bit of a project.
Okay.
But Davis was surprised. He's slimmed down a lot since his junior year of high school. And it's tough to tell with him because he played such poor competition in high school, and he dominated them like you hoped he would. But when you're playing the competition that he's playing, there's only so much that you can take away from that. But he looks the part, and he's got good size, and kind of he was doing a sort of modified Mikan drill where you're just going up for constant layups and dunks on either side of the rim without stopping, and he had some kind of impressive, like, stamina and athleticism and ability to go back up. And I don't know. We'll see. We didn't get to see him in any sort of scrimmage situation or anything like that. But I wouldn't be surprised if he saw the court a decent amount this year.
All right. We got to take a break, and we're going to come back. But before we do that, we'd like to thank our sponsors, Moe's Sports Shop, Underground Printing, the Alumni Association of the University of Michigan, Homeshore Lending, the Residence Inn, Ann Arbor Downtown, Ann Arbor Elder Law, Michigan Law Grad, Tailgate Concierge, and Defensive Drivers Group. Did you know the black and white striped referee uniform seen on the field today was created at Moe's? In the early days of football, officials wore white dress shirts, bow ties, and beret-type hats. But when an Arizona quarterback confused Ypsilanti's Lloyd Olds for a player and mistakenly passed him the ball, he asked his friend George J. Moe to make a distinctive shirt to set him apart. The new striped uniform was effective, but hated by fans. Olds was met with plenty of boos from the crowd when he first wore it in 1921, and more when he called targeting. Moe's Sports Shop is celebrating 100 years of outfitting the Michigan faithful. Visit us at our original 1915 location at 711 North University or online at mostsportshops.com. It's painless. It's online. It's group ordering made easy for your next custom printed apparel order. Pogo from Underground Printing will save you time and hassle. Whether you're selling shirts for a fundraiser, organizing a large event, or trying to collect sizes and payment for a family reunion, UGP is here to help. Save time and hassle every step of the way with our easy-to-use site. No more guessing what to order, chasing down people to pay, or wasting time trying to sort out the order. We'll set it up and you can just sit back and relax. We can even take care of individual shipping. To learn more about Pogo, visit us at any of our convenient locations or at pogo.undergroundshirts.com.
Hey, Ace, have you ever been in a car accident?
I have not.
You have to have been in a car accident for the purposes of this ad.
I apologize for not being in a car accident.
No, you say you've been in a car accident.
I've been in a car accident.
Now what happened to your insurance rates?
They were skyrocketed through the roof.
Thank you. This is a professional podcast.
This is a very professional podcast.
Well, if you are in a car accident and your rates have skyrocketed, the state of Michigan actually allows you to avoid this by taking a defensive driver's class. And Defensive Drivers Group will provide that to you at a low cost. At DefensiveDriversGroup.com, take their online course, completed as 99% other applicants do, and get the states of Michigan, California, and New Jersey to wipe your record clean. There are no hidden fees, and the founders, who are both Michigan grads, will give you $5 off for mentioning this ad. Just say MGO Blah. In southeastern Michigan, the yearly cost for a nursing home averages $90,000. It doesn't have to, though. Reed McCarthy founded Ann Arbor Elder Law after handling a tricky situation for his own family. Years of experience later, his boutique firm works with clients across southeast Michigan dealing with Medicaid planning, long-term care, and tax, disability, and family law, not to mention family dynamics. If you have a family member who may need that level of care, or if you're ready to start your own estate plan, Reed can give you a plan for the future. Visit AnnArborElderLaw.com or call 734-945-9693. That's 734-945-9693.
The infantry stands and holds out its hands. The marshal's binoculars focus and skyward they train. They're searching the yonder blue. They look out for number two. The heraldry of the pencil rain.
All right, now to the other bit of the team. we're gonna split the team up more evenly, but calling someone a power forward just seemed wrong.
Yeah, they don't even know. I mean, they were talking about Duncan Robinson playing either the three or the four. Irving could do the same thing. It's a distinction without a difference for the most part on this team.
So let's talk wings. Obviously, Zach Irvin had a junior year that was not the junior year he wanted. He came into the year with a back injury that kind of seemed to slow him down for a long period of time, and didn't really continue that excellent Zach Irvin we saw late in his sophomore year when everything was on his shoulders.
Yeah, I mean, the back injury really submarined a lot, because with him, when his three-point shot's not on, it's tough for him to create too much offense for himself, because he's not so good off the dribble that he can make up for that. But he did have some progress in a couple of his turnover rate nearly, or his assist rate nearly doubled, because they started using him a lot more off the pick and rolls. So there were some aspects of his game that he rounded out that I thought was impressive, but he also, once they got in the conference season especially, when he was taking the ball to the rim off of those pick and rolls, he was having a really tough time finishing. And since the three-point shot wasn't going down that well, it was a really rough year. So there, I mean, hopefully the shot comes back this year, because he still hasn't been able to match what he did as a freshman when he was mostly just a spot-up guy. But they're hoping for him to be a lot better in a few different areas at this point, especially if he's going to be the focal point of the offense.
Yeah, and then Duncan Robinson was pretty much what you'd expect him to be. He was a dead-eye shooter who was a liability defensively. He had a little Stauskas vibe to him, and you kind of hope that he'll build on that next year.
Yeah, and he's definitely one thing that Beilein mentioned that they were really working on with him, was that now that he's like a marked man, now that the scouting report on him is very much there, they need to do a better job of freeing him up off the ball. So a lot of his off-season work was done on doing those off-ball cuts at a higher speed, working more on taking shots off of quick motion where he's just going right up with it. So trying to adjust to the fact that defense has really figured out, because he went through a little bit of a slump in Big Ten play last year once defenses figured that they just had to really dedicate a lot of their off-ball defense to him. And hopefully it will help with a healthy team. Hopefully a healthy Walton and Irvin will provide some more openings there. But the big key for that is just kind of figuring out how to get him open, because he's not going to be an off-dribble guy.
No, and then DJ Wilson returns. He has not really seen a whole lot of playing time so far. Couldn't stay on the court last year, but some flashes in there of a player who can really stretch the defense and also provide you a lot of size at the four that Michigan hasn't had.
Yeah, he's one of the more intriguing players in terms of a guy who might kind of come out of nowhere and really change the way this team looks. Because if he's able to play the four, I mean, he showed he could hit the occasional three last year. I don't think they still trust that entirely. Beilein mentioned in the press conference at Media Day that they were looking at Wilson, that they kind of had to hammer into him during the offseason that he is an athlete who can shoot, not a shooter who's an athlete. And there was definitely kind of a suggestion there about where his shooting is at. But he was a good weak side shot blocker. That was something that came through in the little bit of time that he was on the court, which would be nice to have in that pack line where you're trying to really discourage guys from even trying to get to the basket. And with him, it's about playing under control, knowing the offense. A lot of his issues the first 2 years have just been knowing where he's supposed to be on the court. So hopefully now that they've kind of settled on that he's a wing, that he's not a post, hopefully this is the year where the game starts to slow down for him a little bit and get him out there, because he's a very different look from what else they could put out there at the four, because it's either Irvin or Robinson really at this point at that spot now that Cam Chapman's gone. And he's obviously a very different player from those two.
And then the only other option that they have on the wing right now is E.B. Watson, a freshman. Not really high regarded, but he could be okay.
Yeah, I'm expecting he needs a year to kind of bulk up, especially if they want to throw him in at that four, or at least have him guard opposing fours. I would guess they more have him as an exclusive three this year. But he's got a reputation as a pretty decent scorer, but one that kind of needed to add some bulk to round out his game, even at the high school level. So he seems like a guy who's probably a year away.
And then they have the three guards who will, I think, rotate pretty much constantly. Muhammad Ali Abdur-Rahman, or Rock, or Mar, or Johnny Marr, whatever. All of these people in one person. Guy who is fearless going to the hole, developed a little bit as a shooter last year, had some really good games, probably Michigan's best perimeter defender, but also ran very much hot and cold.
Yeah, his shot especially kind of comes and goes a little bit, and he had trouble against teams with kind of more dominant interior presences at times. So you can see it kind of coming close to clicking with him, where he could be a really reliable scoring slasher who's also got at least a semi-reliable outside shot too. But he does a lot of the things that the rest of Michigan's players aren't great at doing. He, like you said, he's probably Michigan's best perimeter defender. He was their best player at just creating offense in an isolation situation. He was really the only guy, I would say, who was reliable for taking a guy off the dribble and actually finishing. So there's a lot of room for him to even expand his role in the offense, because he still was a relatively low usage player last year, despite those attributes. I could definitely see that changing a little bit this year, especially since he got a lot better at drawing contact last year and getting to the hole, even over the course of the season. Non-conference, he was not getting to the free throw line that much, and he was 20th in the Big Ten at free throw rate. So there's some potential there for him to kind of round out his scoring ability a little bit by just learning to take more contact.
And he actually threw the ball to a teammate for an assist at least once during the conference season, I remember.
Yes, there was a slight uptick in the assist rate. It got all the way up to 14 in conference play. So he might be learning slowly to kind of actually look for that dish-off option when he gets to the basket and there's a little bit too much attention paid to him.
And then Derek Walton, the starting point guard, going into his senior year. Like Irvin last year, he struggled with injuries, just didn't have that explosion that we saw from him early in his career. I mean, there were a couple of he was an awful, awful shooter inside the three-point line, and that was not the case early in his career. He got a lot of stuff blocked. He didn't have the lift that he used to because he had some foot issues. And, I mean, if he's healthy, he could be a really good player, but he's been dogged with so many injuries so far that that's still somewhat in question.
Yeah, I mean, just the numbers behind that. His freshman year, he was a 45% shooter from inside the arc. The last 2 years, it's been 32% and 36%. He's actually been a better three-point shooter than two-point shooter in each of those years. So there were a couple pointed questions, especially to Billy Donlin, because he's in charge of coaching the guards, about how to get the guards better at finishing. And he chose to kind of focus on the positive and point out one of Walton's better finishes that was an individual play that he saw on tape that shows he's capable. And we've seen that. I mean, his freshman year, he was really good at finishing at the rim. And that the lift hasn't been there. The foot injury's been a problem. That's really the key, because he's turned into a knockdown. He really has been the whole time he's been in Michigan. He's been a knockdown spot-up shooter. And a pretty reliable distributor of the basketball as well. And that was an area that, even though he was a little limited last year, he still improved his assist rate and cut down on his turnovers and became not necessarily a strong perimeter defender, but he was at least coming up with more steals, forcing more turnovers, which in Billy Donlin's defense is a really turnover-heavy, so that might be something to keep an eye on that end this year. assuming that Donlin gets all of these guys better at the whole staying in front of your man part of playing defense. Walton's really, I could see him being an All-Big Ten player this year. I could see him kind of being the player he has been. It's kind of the same case with him and Irvin. There's a lot that's on the table there. Just because the last 2 years, it's been hard to figure out, especially with midseason injuries to Caris LeVert both times that have just changed the way the team functions entirely. It's sort of tough to figure out what you have there, even though both these guys are heading into their senior year.
Yeah, it is very strange that we don't really know what to expect from either of Michigan's supposed senior stars. I mean, just because they haven't been right.
Yeah.
Finally,
yeah.
Xavier Simpson, freshman point guard, generously listed at 6 foot. The next Trey Burke, I guarantee it, top 50 player to Ohio, not to Ohio, from Ohio to ESPN. Yeah. Exciting, penetrating point guard who Michigan yanked out from underneath Wisconsin once the in-state kid, I forget his name, Winston, was slow in deciding. So there's going to be a lot of interesting comparisons between him and Cassius Winston in the next 3-4 years. What can we expect from him as a freshman?
He certainly seems like a very reliable ball handler, distributor of the ball, and he'll be able to get to the rim on a regular basis. He's a really quick player. If you watch his high school highlights, he is not a great shooter, and yet he's a really impressive scorer. So it'll be interesting to see how he fits into Beeline's offense, because I don't think his three-point shot is going to be reliable to the point where he functions like Beeline point guards have of late. You get more of a Darius Morris vibe in terms of how things are going to work with him running the offense, just because the outside shot is not consistently there yet, but he can make up for that with his ability to get to the basket. And also, both Beeline and Donlin talked a decent amount about his ability to be out there in a two-point guard set with Derek Walton, which lets Walton kind of do one of the things that he does best, shoot from a spot up. So I think we're going to see a decent amount of both of those guys out there at the same time. Beeline certainly wasn't shying away from saying that was going to be the case. And with Simpson, mostly for him, it's going to be about getting to the basket and creating from there. They've been working a lot on floaters pulling up with all the guards. And Donlin mentioned that as something that he's noticed. As an area where guards tend to get into trouble, and something that can help improve their finishing at the rim is that they're not great at sometimes they don't recognize when it's a little too contested at the rim and they need to take advantage of that 8 to 12 foot area where they can just kind of pop up and hit a short jumper. And they were working on that quite a bit at the open practice too.
So is this a tournament team?
I think so. You're bringing back, once LeVert went out, Michigan obviously did go on a pretty significant slump after that, but they did rebound. They did push their way into the tournament with pretty much this lineup. And you add Simpson in there, you see hopefully one of the freshman centers will be able to make at least an impact as a rotation player. And I believe that Donlin is going to have a significant impact on the defense. It just hasn't really made sense that the defenses have been as poor as they have, given the talent that Michigan's had. And we discussed the 500% change in emphasis in the offseason. So if that's remotely close to accurate, I have to think that's going to be better. And even under some not-so-ideal conditions with having your best player get hurt each of the last 2 years, Michigan's offenses statistically have still been decent. So if you pull that defense up, I think they do okay. And this is a year where there is not an obvious contender in the Big Ten. I think Wisconsin's kind of the consensus number one team right now, and that's not the most impressive Big Ten front runner that there's been in a while. I'm kind of the mind that Michigan State might end up being the best team, and they're going to rely pretty heavily on freshmen.
What are the chances this is a Sweet 16 seed kind of team, and how do they get there?
You see Walton and Irvin bounce back to kind of the levels that we saw potentially from them as freshmen before injuries and changing roles limited how they played. But I think it mostly comes from Donlin's ability to get the defense – to a level where all of a sudden Beeline's offense is a huge difference maker again.
I think it mostly comes down to Maurice McGarry. That's what it's got to be, man. Mo McGarry.
Yeah, no, that center position and Wagner winning it. If Donald's the day one starting center again, my tournament expectations are going to be ticked down a little bit.
Yeah, all right. Well, so that's the basketball team. Before we let you go, Ace, I want to tell you something.
Fire away.
Bill Connolly has updated his defensive S&P ratings on defense. He has dropped out all the preseason expectations. This is just what is going on this season. Where do you think Michigan ranks on defense, Ace?
I have a feeling it's somewhere around number one.
It is number one. Ace, what do you think Bill Connolly's numbers say? How many points would Michigan give up to an average D1 offense?
It's less than the amount that you can score with any conceivable score in a football game, if I remember correctly.
It is 0.0.
He did actually, unfortunately, he put out a correction.
Oh, he did.
But the correction was almost just as good because with the corrected numbers, Michigan will give up 0.9 points.
0.9 points.
So, yeah, it's heading in a horrible direction. He keeps updating it. This
that trend, that's infinitely poorly, more points than the previous number of points.
So, yeah, that's looking pretty nice. And when you scroll down and you look for average offenses left on the schedule.
Yeah, there's quite a
one.
Few. Yeah.
There's one.
There's one.
it's an above average offense. Let's just say Michigan State doesn't quite make that cut.
No, they do not. All right, Ace, we'll have to talk to you later when you're healthy.
Yes.
Don't die on us.
I will do my best.
All right. That doesn't sound very confident.
I'll make it.
Okay.
I will make it.
All right. We'll have you back in studio next week, I assume.
Yes.
Unless you don't make it. This has been the unnecessarily morbid ending to this part of the podcast. In 1934, a salesman from Champion Sportswear walked into Moe's Sports Shop. There, he teamed up with George J. Moe to create the very first University of Michigan-branded shirt. After seeing the high demand for this product, Champion went to the other Big Ten schools with the same proposal, and the collegiate apparel industry was born. Moe's Sports Shops is celebrating 100 years of outfitting the Michigan faithful. Visit us at our original 1915 location at 711 North University, or online at 100years.moe. That's 100years.moe.
Want the perfect game day outfit? Underground Printing has unique, great-fitting UM apparel and officially licensed apparel from legendary Michigan names like Woodson, Howard, Schembechler, Ufer, and more. UGP also specializes in custom-printed apparel and promotional items for groups, events, and businesses. Whether you need one shirt as a gift or 1,000 shirts for a charity walk, Underground can customize almost anything for groups large or small. To learn more, visit Underground Printing at one of our three convenient locations around Ann Arbor or online at undergroundshirts.com.
As Jim Harbaugh and the 2016 Michigan Wolverines begin their journey towards a 43rd Big Ten championship and 12th national title, it's important that you're also preparing for this historic season. If you find yourself on the wrong side of the law, in Ann Arbor or around Metro Detroit, you want a Michigan man in the huddle. Call former prosecutor and now criminal defense attorney Jonathan Paul at 248-924-9458 or visit his website, michiganlawgrad.com.
If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, fully equipped kitchen and every suite, and an indoor pool. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
The places you'll go may seem far from Ann Arbor. From San Francisco to St. Louis to Shanghai. But as members of the Alumni Association, we're never far. Because Michigan is more than a place. It's a mindset that connects us. For those who leave Michigan, but for whom Michigan never leaves, this is where you belong. The Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Join today at umalumni.com.
We'll be right back.
welcome in a special guest, Larry Deitch, who is, of course, a regent for the University of Michigan. How long have you been in that spot?
This is my 24th year, Brian.
24th year. Wow.
Yeah. the terms are 8 years, and I'm completing my third term.
That's – so you probably have a better insight into the actual, you know, machinations that get the university to be where it is than anybody else. Has anybody else been on the Regents Board that long?
There have been some others that have served three terms, but if I'm elected to my fourth term, I will tie the record of a man named Junius P. Beale, who was a regent from 1908 to 1940.
Well, that's definitely something to shoot for. I thought we would, you know, kind of talk about, you know, where the American University is, where Michigan fits in that, and kind of then maybe go off into some more specific topics about the University of Michigan.
Great.
So I've been looking this up, and in the past 20 years, in-state tuition has gone up by, I think, 120%. Outside tuition, I think, has gone up even more rapidly than that. And we had a conversation with John U. Bacon earlier where we were at a bar just kind of, you know, shooting the shit. And, you know, you mentioned that part of that was the fact that Michigan, it has a different price for people who can afford more versus afford less.
You know, over that period of time, there has been a profound disinvestment by the state of Michigan in public higher education, where once upon a time we created great institutions through our investment and seeing higher education as the societal good that it is. That hasn't been the case for really the last 30 years. But trying to balance keeping Michigan as great as it is and should be with keeping it reasonably accessible to people of average means is a tough one. And we've tried to strike a balance through good management, and cost cutting and things like that. But at the same time, recognizing that to keep our edge as certainly the best public university in America, and I think maybe arguably the best university in America, you know, we've had to raise tuition. But as we've raised tuition, we've had a consistent commitment to financial aid so that any Michigan student of average means who qualifies to be at Michigan won't be unable to attend because of cost.
So I actually looked this up. If you are kind of in the median range, it's 45 to 75 on the site that I looked up. Your sticker price at Michigan for an in-state is about $11,000. I mean, not sticker price, your actual out-of-pocket.
It's actually a little bit more now. It's more like 13-something.
Okay. So is that a reasonable amount for somebody making – for a household making $50,000 to $60,000 a year? Or is that something where you'd like to see that come down? I mean, obviously, at some point,
I think one of the things – I think coming down is somewhat unrealistic.
I don't mean as like a sticker price thing. I mean like as like a – I mean, we have this endowment now, right? And 30 years ago, Michigan basically didn't have one, and they've gone up to the point where they're now, I think, the number one most endowed public school in the country. If it's either Michigan or Virginia, I think.
Well, there's also the University of Texas, which gets has a license fee from every bit of oil that came out of the state of Texas.
That must be nice.
Yeah, I think Texas is number one.
But we're
up there.
Michigan has done a good job of building that endowment into a powerhouse. And at some point, you know, you're looking at what are we going to do with all this money? And Michigan's answer seems to be we're going to build a bunch of stuff. And I know that since, you know, you keep the sticker price for an international student is so high, sticker price for an out of state student is so high, they come in with certain expectations. So that's – you see – you go into North Quad and, man, that's different than South Quad.
It is. I lived in West Quad once upon a time and I was by there yesterday. And it looks better today because we've reinvested. But I remember the old South Quad, West Quad and South Quad.
Right. So there's this pressure to be able to provide this kind of full price experience that causes you to like, all right, if we're going to get –
a bunch of Chinese students paying $50,000 a year and a bunch of kids from New York paying $35,000 a year, we're going to need to offer them something that looks as impressive as their tuition bills look.
Well, look, number one, there's tremendous demand to come to Michigan. There's right. over 55,000 applications a year. The so-called common application has contributed to it. By the way, there's clearly a relationship when we're doing great on the football field to the number of applications. But my point is the demand for Michigan is tremendous worldwide, certainly nationally. But we feel that we have an obligation to the people of Michigan to provide opportunity. You know, the great saying that I quote all the time that goes back to the 19th century to James B. Angel, who was president of the university in the 19th century. We provide an uncommon education for the common man. And I don't ever want to see us lose that ethos. And so we have, as we raise tuition, we make every time we make an increased commitment to financial aid so that family making $50,000 to $60,000 probably ends up paying very little, if anything. I think the number goes into, you know, well over 100,000. I don't have that stat in my head at the moment.
Sure.
120, 150. But it's not easy. Don't get me wrong. But, you know, I think back, I graduated the law school in 1972, and my first job, which was a good job, I remember it very clearly, I was paid $14,500. So, you know, it's always a little dangerous. And I think of my folks, my dad had a small business.
Sure.
It was a lot cheaper, but it was not without sacrifice from families at that point in time either.
Well, I always go back to the fact that I was fortunate enough to have my parents pay for my education. And I got a master's as well that my dad paid for. My mom paid for the undergrad, my dad paid for the master's. And I get to do what I do today because I didn't have, you know, $50,000 in debt.
Right.
I was working an engineering job and I started this blog and I got fired from it for writing the blog too much. And I was like, yeah, that's fair. and then I just decided to take a shot at this because I didn't have to pay $600, $700, $1,000 a month to debt. And I
worry about it a lot too. I mean, I graduated from college without debt as well. You know, my parents paid what they could pay.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the day, you could actually get summer jobs.
Right.
You know, in an auto plant here in Michigan, or one summer I drove a truck for the Free Press. You could make quite a bit of money and help, you know, make that payment. When I went to law school, I'd gotten married young and my wife was a school teacher. And so, you know, we did okay. And I started my career with zero debt. Happily, because of the education that I got at Michigan, I've had a successful career as a lawyer, and my three children have graduated without debt. But I worry about people that were just like my sister and me, who were children of people of average
right.
means. We weren't poor. We certainly weren't rich. But we were both able to go to Michigan and graduate and come out debt free. So, you know, the question of getting more investment into the state, into state public higher education is something we all should care about. And there is discussion, at least on the Democrat side, of coming up with plans for people to lessen the debt burden. And I think it's really important.
This is outside the scope of our conversation,
yeah.
though, because whatever happens nationally happens nationally. I mean, you talk a lot about the disinvestment from the state, but we also see the out-of-state tuition continue to go up at a really high rate. And
well, it does, but you know, it's very interesting that the differential between in-state and out-state, the gap, the delta, actually represents what the missing state appropriation is. So we've got a situation where Michigan is highly desirable mm-hmm. nationally, but And so that there's, you know, more than enough qualified applicants who are willing to pay the full boat. And
so you have to make a choice whenever you admit an in-state student, like, are we going to – I mean, the amount of money that we're not getting from this person's tuition plus whatever the state contribution is versus somebody else.
Correct.
So is there a base level of undergraduate in-state enrollment that you don't ever want to cross?
You know, it's a line that is you gotta look at very carefully. We're in the high 40s now in terms of out of state, and you know, so I would have to describe it as a gut call.
Yeah, once that crosses under 50%, that's kind of like a, you know, that kind of wakes you up a little bit, I think.
Yeah, it feels as if we're close to, you know, what the maximum should be in terms of balancing the history of investment in Michigan and the role as an engine in the state of Michigan versus part of what makes, in my mind, the Ann Arbor campus particularly a unique place is there's people from all over the country and indeed all over the world. And so it's a balance between getting that diversity and different perspective versus, you know, serving the people of the state of Michigan. And we try to strike that balance.
Yeah, so I'm an engineer. I want to hear a number. you're not going to
I was a history major and a lawyer.
Yeah, so you're not going to get a number.
You can see I'm much more comfortable in a grayer area.
Yeah.
I'm talking to an engineer. Wow.
Well, no. Well, so.
Yeah. I mean, that 50%, I'd like to keep us, you know, I think about where we are.
Yeah.
Is about right.
Okay.
I'm not saying that there couldn't be a set of circumstances where it goes higher in the next 8 years or beyond, but I kind of like where we are.
All right. Let's talk about your actual role as a regent.
Yeah.
So I don't think many people – this is a terrible admission. I didn't really have much sense of what the regents – who they were or what they did until the fireworks vote.
Right.
And I was like, I didn't know they could do that.
That might be in my obituary.
So
let me explain.
Yeah.
And we can use that as an example.
Sure.
Right? The Constitution of Michigan creates 8-person boards to run the University of Michigan, Michigan State, and Wayne State.
Okay.
Those boards are popularly elected, meaning they're elected statewide hopefully I will be reelected on November 8th. Two people run every 2 years. And if you read the language of the Constitution, the boards have, quote, general supervision over the institution and control over all expenditures. There's also a specific statement about electing the president of the university from time to time.
Okay.
So what all that means when you get out of the legalistic language is that we're like the board of directors of a major public corporation.
Okay.
Meaning we have control over literally everything. Now, it's not a full-time job.
Yeah. You guys meet monthly.
We meet monthly.
And you vote on proposals that the university provides to you.
Typically, I mean, there have been lots of things that have sort of been region driven,
yeah.
But we try not to get involved in the day to day running of the university. We try to deal at a policy level and a directional level.
Okay.
So we actually every year pass the budget, including the budget for the athletic department. The budget for the hospital, and you're talking all in at a number over $7 billion. So University of Michigan, by the way, is also the largest employer in the state of Michigan with about 45,000 employees on the three campuses. The fireworks is an interesting story.
Sure.
Under Michigan law, in order to have a fireworks display – it has to be approved by the governing body. of the
like this is a specific law about fireworks.
Yeah, it is. It's a, I don't know exactly where it is, but it has to do with, you know, it's in the fire marshal's code, right?
Okay.
So like if you were doing fireworks at Briarwood Mall,
yeah.
The Ann Arbor City Council would have had to pass it.
Oh, I see.
Okay. So when it comes to the University of Michigan, the Board of Regents is it. So the proposal came to us, and it gave us an opportunity to for the majority of us to speak to
issues,
yeah. and how we saw.
Well, look, I can be diplomatic.
that was pretty good. How we saw this fitting into our institutional values.
So one thing that kind of came out of this is, you know, this proposal got voted down, and there were articles in the paper about it that noted that, you know, for the past like 300 issues, all of them had been approved 8-0. So is this a situation where, you know, you don't want to get involved in the day-to-day of the university? So if someone presents you with a budget, unless there's something completely out of hand there, you're just going to vote yes? Or is there like – that kind of feels like a little bit too rubber stampy to me.
Well, look, a lot of the stuff that we deal with is not controversial. I'm not sure that, you know, your numbers were exactly right.
You
were like a creative engineer there for a moment.
I'm paraphrasing. I might not be exactly right, but there were just a huge proportion of past amendments, and this was like a real outlier.
Let me go back to something where I was in the minority, but was really outspoken about it. I didn't want to see the major $225 million addition to the big house.
The luxury boxes.
I was against it.
Okay.
And spoke out against it throughout the whole time. It wasn't that I didn't think the big house needed some renovation. It did. It wasn't that I didn't think it needed improvement. It did. But to me, that kind of expenditure symbolically – when we're talking about cost and so forth, and it came up, you know, in the recession period, was something that we shouldn't be doing, and so I was opposed to it, as was another regent. The majority were for it. I did look at that time, and you know, there was a pretty consistent record of support for. Recommendations by the administration. But as I say, a lot of the things that we pass are, you know, fixing the windows and the HVAC system in West Quad. They're not controversial.
I would have voted that down. I live in South Quad. Those guys can go jump in a lake.
So a lot of it's not controversial. And then a lot of it, by the time it gets to a vote, we've had input. And we've had some, you know, discussion about it, and, you know, we've been briefed on it. And so, you know, we try to operate as much on a consensus as we can. But when there are matters of principle or policy, we weigh in.
Okay. So a couple of more specific, I guess, issues facing the university right now. Since I think it was 2000, I don't remember the exact year, but the OCR issues a Dear Colleague letter instructing the University of Michigan and universities nationwide to use a preponderance of the evidence standard when adjudicating sexual assault disputes on campus.
Yeah.
And Michigan, along with a lot of other schools, has been caught between a rock and a hard place where they are – directed to take this seriously. They really should take it seriously. But then you start getting into issues of due process, and you're seeing a lot of students nationwide who've been expelled start suing the universities. Michigan settled with a guy named Drew Sterrett.
Yes. I'm very familiar with the case.
So I was most struck by a Slate article on this case.
I read the article.
Where both Drew Sterrett and the woman who's still anonymous who accused Sterrett said that you shouldn't take this to the university. Drew Sterrett was expelled from the university, sued the university, and settled for I think an undisclosed sum of money
But obviously something where the university didn't want to see it go to court. The statements from both sides kind of seem like Michigan did not do particularly well by either side in this case. And I wonder about, you know, the kind of the closed nature of these proceedings. And you don't want sexual assault accusers, victims, you don't want their names out in the public. But at some point, these kind of feel a little bit too secretive to be reliable.
This is a complex topic.
It is.
Number one, we've got to do everything that we can do to eliminate or at a minimum profoundly diminish incidents of sexual assault on our campus. And, you know, what we've been looking at the last couple weeks, you know, with Trump's statements and so forth.
Also outside the scope of our conversation, I think. I hope.
Well, my point is it just makes us all cognizant.
Sure.
Of how ugly a thing misogyny is. So we have to have policies that are intended to defer sexual assault, where a sanction is appropriate to issue it, but we have to have a system that is fair and honors due process. If you left it to me, I don't like the preponderance of the evidence standard.
Okay.
As a lawyer.
It's been imposed on Michigan, though.
It's been imposed on Michigan by the federal government.
Yeah.
You know, we've had discussions about whether, you know, we should stand out there and challenge the U.S. Department of Education.
And you decided no.
Well, there hasn't been an outcry
sure.
of support from other universities, right?
Yeah.
And, you know, the preponderance of the evidence means to a lawyer, a little more than 50%.
Yeah, 51.49.
51.49. Yeah, even maybe less, maybe 50.1, 49.9. Clear and convincing means what it means, what it sounds like, more likely than not. And that is a standard below the criminal standard, which is beyond a reasonable doubt. Okay? But it's a standard that, at least for the time being, we're living with. So to me, that means that we've got to have fair investigative standards, you know, a process that protects both the accuser and the accused, and that is balanced in trying to make decisions in cases that very often boil down to he said, she said.
How do you – I mean, this is your wheelhouse. You are a lawyer. How on earth do you do that? You don't know. Nobody knows.
Well, you know, you don't know. I mean, it's tough. But in the Sterrett case, to me, the evidence did not point to the finding that was made. All right? In other words, there were enough facts
right.
to make it murky enough – that bringing a charge that led to an expulsion wasn't the right thing to do. So I was very pleased to see the case resolved. I thought it was the appropriate resolution.
Have you guys taken any steps to make sure that doesn't happen again, insofar as that is possible? I mean,
I hope so. We've, you know, there have been some changes to the policy and to the process in terms of. Trying to – one of the things that was wrong in that case that was the initial investigator was also a trier of fact.
Okay.
Investigator and judge.
Sure.
I don't think that works.
No.
Right? And so we have been working on modifying the process so there's more rigorous, transparent due process. And I think it'll help.
So what do you exactly mean by transparent? Like, how does that – I mean, can you release the anonymized proceedings of these things to – or
I mean, is there
what I mean by transparent in that context is transparent to both the accuser and the accused of what the rules of the game are.
So, I mean, one of the things that I think is detrimental about the OCR letter is it, you know, usually these things end up in the courts when they do end up in the courts, and there are observers, and you don't really, I mean, I understand that you can't just like put it on television, but at some point, you know, some sort of neutral observer from, I don't know, FIRE, which is the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, or some other third-party group, just to check on, or the ACLU. Like,
if you left it to me, in a perfect world, I would shift the whole thing to the court system. But reasonable people say that will diminish significantly the number of reported incidents of sexual assault, because women do not want to subject themselves to this, the court system, and, you know, that kind of public disclosure and cross-examination and character assassination and so forth.
And it seems like that's a problem with the court system that now has fallen on the universities, but this isn't really.
And so, you know, we're not. You know, we're not a court system, and so I think we're working our way through it to come up with a balance that would be fair. I haven't given up on my belief that clear and convincing would be an important start.
Sure, that would be
okay. I haven't given up on that. And, you know, we're going to see how it – if I continue to be a regent, we're going to see how it evolves over the next years. I feel strongly about that. There are other people on the board who agree. It's a delicate matter, because the incidents of sexual assault are prevalent, and they are repugnant. And so when you talk about clear and convincing, oftentimes you get into a dialogue where it's perceived that you're soft,
right,
on sexual assault. And so, you know, over the years I've been on the board, Brian, I think I've been pretty good at trying to, you know, drive consensus on things. People know where I stand on stuff. You know, when I opposed expanding the stadium, I knew, you know, half the people would think that's really cool. I got a lot of support, you know, emails and the like. Half the people would think I was a jerk.
I didn't think you were a jerk particularly, but there was the guy who kept running in the New York Times who I thought was a jerk.
He was a jerk. he was a jerk, actually. But as it turned out, you know, and look, and Bill Martin would tell you this, and we talk about it all the time, that you know, he believed that I was coming at it from a point of principle, and that every time that I made a statement in opposition to it, I said, look, it's going to pass. I hope I'm wrong, and I hope it's successful. I said things like, it's not going to come in on budget. It did. You know, I think some of my opposition actually helped make it a better design.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I just drove by the stadium yesterday. The Main Street side, which I don't usually see, you know, the athletic department was determined to raise money, you know, so they raised, you know, I think $5 million chunks, you know,
with
to
the
name the
rights,
corners
yeah.
of the towers. Okay. It's not what I would have, if I had $5 million bucks lying around, it's not what I would have given it to, but hey, it's a free country. Right. And, so, you know, I think you can be for things or opposed to things in a democratic process, and, you know, the majority rules. But people that I work with know that I come at it straight.
We talked a little bit about transparency. Why is the FOA office at Michigan so bad? So a few years ago, the Daily did a comparison. They asked for parking ticket data. And most of the Big Ten schools offered it for free. Michigan State had a nominal fee. I think there was one other school that had kind of a more expensive thing. And then Michigan's asking for $600, $700. I've had some personal experience with this because I had to do some FOIA stuff because I was trying to confirm various emails. And they were quoting me things like $1,200 for a simple email search. And even if you have to redact some stuff, which I don't think that was the case, you're still looking at a few hours of work for a couple people. So to me, it feels like that aspect of the University FOIA office is kind of deliberately obfuscatory, and that frustrates me to no end.
I'm nodding my head. It's a fair comment. I mean, I think we're on the tough side of those sorts of things.
Okay.
I guess.
Can we do something about that?
Well, maybe we can. I honestly haven't. I haven't felt passionately about it one way or the other. Maybe because I'm not. I haven't looked at it from your perspective.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, I mean, for me, you know. You've done an admirable job about talking about the University of Michigan as something other than business.
I don't believe that's the way to talk about it.
I 100% agree. And part of that, I think, is having public records that are in the spirit of the law, not just the letter of the law. So, you know, when I was doing this and some things were coming back as not responsive, somebody who had knowledge of the policies within the department noted that people go through and manually delete emails so that there isn't this record. So after 90 days, you're just not going to find anything. And to me, that feels like it's against the spirit. I mean, there are some things in that should not be covered by FOIA laws, but most of them, you know, have to do with the military. There's nothing about the University of Michigan that I feel shouldn't have the ability for the public to look at it and say, maybe yes, maybe no. And I feel like the FOIA office at Michigan has the exact opposite opinion.
There are some things that generally I would agree with you, but there are some things where I think there's a need for sensitivity, and that has to do, I think, principally with our competitive status, particularly as it relates to the operation of the health system, right?
Okay.
Okay. I mean, that's a – you know, over $7 billion budget, that's about four some, right? And we're competing. We're in a healthcare environment where we're competing with private institutions, whether it's the Henry Ford system or the Beaumont system in Detroit area or the Spectrum system in West Michigan and Grand Rapids. And so a complete full disclosure of some of the things relating to our health system would put us at a competitive disadvantage. There are other things like that, but beyond those sorts of things, I have no problem with a full disclosure of things.
Okay. Well, hopefully, if you do get reelected,
but honestly, I haven't really thought about it from your perspective. I mean, I just, you know what I'm saying? It's kind of like we're sitting across each other from a table, and on your side of the table, I get it. I hear where you're coming from, and from my perspective, it hasn't been something that I've been passionate about.
So we've been talking about, you know, people don't really know what the regents do. People who really care about the University of Michigan, like everybody in this room, don't always know how it's being run and whether it's being run well. And for most of the time, it's just we assume that's the case, but sometimes – things kind of jump out at you and you want to look at it, and then it's difficult for you to do so. And
big institutions sometimes do things that are dumb.
Yeah. Or
less than admirable.
And there's a certain bureaucratic momentum.
There is.
That kind of gets involved, and you kind of have to take a pickaxe to it if you're ever going to get that done.
It's not simple. I mean, the old battleship metaphor is clearly applicable to, you know, a place with, you know, over three campuses, over 60,000 students, 45,000 employees, you know, et cetera.
I'll send you this article from the Daily.
Right.
And we'll see if something gets done.
All right. Fine.
One thing that I was going to kind of poke at you about, but I talked to my wife about it. My wife is an adjunct at the university. And I talked to her about how much she gets paid, how much she would get paid if she had a 1.0. She's at 0.77. And I was going to kind of get after you about kind of the general university thing where you're relying so much less on tenured professors and you're relying so much more on adjuncts, and those adjuncts are paid at poverty wages. Happily, that's not the case at the University of Michigan.
Well, that's in part I think there's two aspects to it. I mean, number one, we aim to treat people fairly.
Sure.
But number two, you know, about a dozen years ago, the lecturers were able to vote to have a union. And it's called LEO. And it has been very effective in representing the interest of the non-tenure track faculty. And a lot of what we do, we're going back to the things we talked about tuition increases. You know, a lot of the greatness of the university relates to our renowned faculty. And for them, we operate in a very competitive environment in terms of, you know, Stanford coming to recruit them or Harvard or whatever. But the backbone of undergraduate teaching, are the non-tenure track faculty, most of whom have PhD degrees and are devoted to their work and their students. And I want to see them treated and compensated fairly. And I'm proud of the role I've played in achieving that.
Yeah, so that was going to be a longer segment, but there's not actually a problem there, I don't think. I mean,
Well, you know, I mean, and look, again, there's an example of how I try to approach a thing in terms of being straight with people.
Yeah.
Some years back, the university, for all of its employees, had no employee contribution to healthcare, right?
Yeah.
And that was the old paradigm, but as healthcare insurance was going up and up and up, we could no longer do that. And so over a period of time, we implemented employee contributions for our non-represented, non-union employees. When the LEO folks, their contract came up right after that, you know, some of the leadership came to me and said, hey, you know, we're lower wage people, and we can't afford this. And, you know, I said to him, look, we made everybody else do it. I was for that. I'd be a hypocrite to say I'm for it for everybody except you folks. And I think if you deal straight with people, they respect that and accept it. And that's what I've tried to do.
You are up for re-election.
Yes.
I imagine people would – you would like people to vote for you.
I would.
So we've talked, and I think you've made your case as someone who's been around the university for a very long time and has been able to work with both Republicans and Democrats to get things done. Any closing thoughts so that people will pull the trigger for you?
You know, it's been a privilege for me to do this. Michigan's meant a lot to me. I grew up in Detroit, as I said earlier. I wasn't a kid who came from a wealthy family, and so to have this great university here down the road a piece, so to speak, for me was really transformative in my life. And so I've been passionate about keeping it equally great for other people. I work hard at it. I approach things with integrity, and I think the results are speak for themselves, right? I mean, we aim to be great at everything we do. You know, we've begun to get the recognition that we deserve as the best public university in America. And I think when I look at how great we are at everything we do, I think we should be ranked even higher than we are. And if I'm reelected, that's what I'm going to continue to do. I do believe in that concept of an uncommon education for the common person, to use the current language. I want to keep Michigan both really great and really egalitarian. And when I look at what we're doing in our sports program and intercollegiate athletics, seeing Michigan returning to greatness in football is consistent with my view that we should be great at everything we do. That's all part of who we are. That's part of the Michigan culture. Some non-Michigan people refer to our arrogance. There was a wonderful article by Jason Gay in the Wall Street Journal before the Wisconsin game about how much he hates us because of our pride in Michigan. And Jason, I plead guilty.
Well, and edits him was a Michigan grad as well.
I know. So. I know. It's great.
And then all 14 of them at the Wall Street Journal had a rebuttal.
Yeah.
So, you can't throw a rock at a major newspaper without hitting a Michigan graduate. Right. All right. Larry Deitch.
Deitch.
Deitch. I got it right.
Got it right.
Ace isn't here today, so my pronunciation guide is off. Thank you for coming
in. Thank you, Brian.
If you're running for regent and you're listening to this, we will provide an open platform for you to discuss similar issues. But it's been great to have Larry with us.
What would make your next visit to a Michigan game even better? How about getting together with your family and friends for a great tailgate with no effort? It's so easy thanks to Tailgater Concierge. Just go to tailgaterconcierge.com and choose one of their most popular packages or create a customer order to fit your specific needs. They will take care of the rest by setting up your tailgate right across from the stadium on Main Street and cleaning up afterwards to ensure you are on time for kickoff. Tailgater Concierge, an easier way to tailgate.
The places you'll go may seem far from Ann Arbor. From San Francisco to St. Louis to Shanghai. But as members of the Alumni Association, we're never far. Because Michigan is more than a place. It's a mindset that connects us. For those who leave Michigan, but for whom Michigan never leaves, this is where you belong. The Alumni Association of the University of Michigan. Join today at umalumni.com.
If you need a place to stay in Ann Arbor and don't want to be stuck out by I-94, there's a new hotel downtown, and the owners, who should be well known to the Michigan community, have asked our help to get the word out. The Martin family, yes, that Martin family, recently opened the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown, just a block from Main Street and a short walk to Michigan Stadium. They're competitively priced and offer a free hot breakfast, free Wi-Fi, fully equipped kitchen and every suite and an indoor pool. That's the Residence Inn Ann Arbor downtown.
Hi, this is Matt Demarest from Homeshare Lending. By now, you've probably read about my company on MGO blog, and I wanted to introduce you to a couple of the most important people in my life, my sons Cooper and Colby. Cooper, how old are you?
I'm 7.5.
Colby, how old are you?
I'm 5.
Okay, boys, I have 3 really important questions to ask you. Who's your favorite team?
Michigan.
Who's going to win the big game?
The Wolverines.
And if you could buy or refinance a house with any company, who would you use?
Homeshare Lending.
Good boys. Homeshare Lending, 855-6-BE-SURE. Visit us online if that works better for you, homeshurelending.com, HOMESURE lending.com. We've helped Brian, Seth, and a bunch of readers buy or refinance their homes, and we'd love to help you too. All right, only thing left to do. Boys, can I get a Go Blue?
Go Blue.
Homeshare Lending, NMLS number 1161358. Again, give us a call, 855-6-BE-SURE.
We welcome in Jamie Mack of JustCoverBlog.com. How you doing, Jamie?
I'm doing great. I miss Ace, but I realize he's resting up because he's going to have to watch tape of that Illinois Rutgers game for his FFF post.
Is he? Does he have to? I don't know.
No, he's probably not. Actually, I asked him if he was DVRing it, and he emphatically said he was not. But then people started guilting him about it, so maybe he did. So.
He probably did. Illinois 24, Rutgers 7, in a game where Rutgers actually gains almost 400 yards of offense and outgains Illinois by like 70 yards, which is – I don't even know how that happens.
Yeah.
But – Rutgers was shut out until I think it was 17-0, and they got a touchdown on an RPO-type play. And the Twitters went berserk because Rutgers had crossed the goal line. But this was a much more even game than the score would imply.
Yeah, it was actually a lot like the game they lost to Iowa a few weeks ago where they lost 14-7 to the Hawkeyes, because in that game they moved the ball pretty well, but they came up empty on 3 red zone trips, and against Illinois, they had 2 really good drives early in the game, but they fumbled it away on one of them, and then on another one, they were trying to go for it on 4th and 2, like on Illinois' 18, and if you recall, the shotgun snap practically went over Laviano's head, and that play had no chance, but they definitely left a lot of points on the field. And then Illinois finally got it going and got up 17-0, and you're just looking back at those lost chances, and you're like, wow, Rutgers would have been in this game in the fourth quarter had they executed better in some scoring chances.
So Illinois, probably not very good.
No.
Good.
No. I think the only question going into next week's game against Michigan is, will Michigan be on a shutout streak going into the state game like they were last year? Because, I just don't had 92 yards passing against Rutgers yesterday.
Jeez.
And 61 of them came on a little dump-off screen to Keyshawn Vaughn. I mean, they're.
So Chase Crouch is Illinois' new quarterback. Had a really good debut last week, but this week, 6.6 yards an attempt. He had 2.3 yards a rush on 11 rushes. And, if Rutgers is shutting you down, what is Michigan's defense going to do to you?
Yeah, exactly.
All right, I think we should move on. Minnesota 31, Maryland 10, in another game that looks pretty even in the stats. Minnesota outgained them 311 to 291, outgained them slightly per play. But, the most notable thing in this game is that Maryland has a quarterback that is apparently named Piggy, which
right.
I thought I was mishearing, and people on Twitter was like, nope, his last name is Pigrone, and he prefers to go by Piggy. So that's how you pass for.
We all have our nicknames, I guess.
That's how you pass for 4.4 yards in an attempt against Minnesota, as people call you, Piggy. I don't know where to go from here.
He had 62 combined dropbacks and carries against Minnesota, and he only had 231 total yards on those plays. 4.4 yards per pass, like you just mentioned, but he only had 2.8 yards per rush. And he was their leader in carries by far yesterday. They almost ignored their running backs for some reason in this game. Piggy did not look good. It goes to show you how fragile you can look sometimes early, those improvements early in the season. They need Perry Hills back. As bad as Perry Hills was last year, they need to get him back in the lineup. We talked about how Illinois has no chance going up against the Michigan's defense. If Maryland shows up in Ann Arbor with Piggy as their quarterback, he's going to get hurt.
Lord of the Flies, man. Kill or be killed.
Yeah.
The other notable thing from this game is that Minnesota did not have Mitch Leidner. Apparently their backup is quarterback is not a first-round NFL draft pick. But it didn't really matter for them because their two main tailbacks combined for 40 carries for almost 250 yards.
Yeah. Finally, they listened to what we were talking about last week. They by halftime, Brooks and Smith had as many carries as they did in the whole game against Iowa. And,
those are the best players on their team.
I know. That's why it's so stunning that they just lost sight of them, last week. And they've got to be kicking themselves, losing to Iowa in the fourth quarter, losing to Penn State in the fourth quarter. I don't think they're as good as Wisconsin or Nebraska, but they would be right in the thick of this West race if they had tucked one of those away, if not both of them, because they're going to go on a run. They play Illinois, Rutgers, and Purdue in their next three games. So the Gophers are going to go on a little bit of a run.
They are, such as it is.
And they're going to be in position. Like remember 2 years ago, they kind of snuck around and got to the finale against Wisconsin with a chance in that divisional race. If they take care of business, they've got a big game against Nebraska after this easy stretch. But they find a way to win that game, they could end up in that finale again against the Badgers with the division somehow on the line. The Badgers already have two losses as well.
Iowa 49, Purdue 35. I think the first one of those scores is expected. The last one is not, but to be fair to Iowa, they ran out to a huge lead in this game, and Purdue had a lot of garbage time that they used productively, as Purdue is wont to do. But the total yards in this game is kind of alarming. Iowa 520, Purdue 504. Like, David Blau.
It was 35-7 at halftime. It was 42-14 at the end of three quarters. But, Purdue is definitely moving the ball. I felt like, I'm always paying, whether or not I'm actually betting on a game or not, I'm always paying attention to the lines. And, Iowa's a 12-point favorite. And, after they got up to that 42-14 lead, it felt like the whole rest of the game was Purdue knocking on the door to get a backdoor cover. So they definitely had something going against Iowa for the longest time. But for the first time in a long time, Iowa's offense, though, finally got going. We've talked about how many three-and-outs or worse they've had over the last month. They only had two of those drives yesterday, and they came in the fourth quarter after they had leapt out to a 42-14 lead.
And they just ground up Purdue on the ground. I saw a stat on television yesterday that Iowa is averaging 5 or 6 yards a carry in their wins and 1.4 in their losses. So feels like, you know, maybe some fool's gold here because they're playing Purdue, especially because
Purdue. You know, if you do fantasy football type stuff, I guess, you know, take Daniels or Wadley if I was playing a crappy team. And
yeah,
there's enough crappy teams in the Big Ten where that's a decent strategy probably every other week.
Well, and this was also Purdue without Jacob Plogle, who is not only their best player, but probably one of the best players in the Big Ten. So Purdue minus like their one heroic defender, and they just blew him out on the ground. All right,
good to know that the great Rapogle family tradition is going on somewhere.
It's so strange. Like, by the third one, you'd think Michigan, Ohio State would be like, maybe we should get this guy.
Yeah, totally.
But no, Purdue or Indiana, every single one of them. Speaking of Indiana 22, Nebraska 27, in a Tommy Armstrong special kind of game where he completes about 40% of his passes, but hits a number of bombs, one of which is a miraculous catch by one of his wide receivers. He also throws two terrible interceptions, They managed to pull it out because Indiana's offense just isn't what it was last year.
No, and that boy, that's too bad too, because they finally have a defense.
Yeah,
which is a crazy enough thought. They've just played Ohio State and Nebraska in back-to-back weeks, Indiana, and they lost both games. But if you're looking for a silver lining, it is that defense. They actually improved their defensive yards per play ranking by one. They were 37th nationally going into the Ohio State game. They're 36th now after playing Ohio State and Nebraska in back-to-back weeks. And the defense is the only reason why they had a chance to even win that game yesterday. Nebraska gets out to a 17-0 lead because of, one, that miraculous catch that you referenced. That set him up for a touchdown. And then the Hoosiers quarterback, Richard Legault, throws a pick six. So they're down 17-0. On Nebraska's next nine drives, and this takes us well into the fourth quarter, they only gained 85 total yards. And Indiana just sort of picked away at the lead. They forced six punts during that stretch. They got two interceptions, like you talked about. They also got a safety. And they ended up scoring 15 consecutive points, getting a safety and getting a field goal and finally getting a touchdown that was set up by a big punt return. Yeah, the offense, it's just too bad. If the defense looked anything like this these last couple years, Kevin Wilson would already be the head coach at Texas, probably.
But
I said this last week, this is another silver lining part two. The defense improvements, I think we can say, are legit, and they've got the whole crew back next year. So if they can find some improvement out of the quarterback position and find a way to get a little bit of that offensive mojo back, they could have something real. They could have something exciting next year. Problem is that quarterback, guys, he's got a little bit of Devin Gardner in him, you know, because not only is he a little bit turnover prone, but I don't need to remind you this, all of Devin's turnovers were always like the worst case situation. Every turnover, he's already had like three pick sixes this year. He had that fumble last week against Ohio State that set the Buckeyes up in first and goal. I mean, it's just aggravating. But I think that the defense, though, I think it's better to have a better defensive program than a better offensive program. I know that hurts everybody's feelings that wants to see team chaos. But
yeah,
I like their chances the rest of the year. You know, Maryland, Rutgers, Purdue, those should all be wins. Michigan will be a loss. Northwestern and Penn State, those are looking like some exciting toss-up games. They've got a shot at eight wins.
They do. Xander Diamont played in this game. What's the deal with that?
That's interesting. I think that is because of how ineffective the offense is. You know, they don't trust Lego downfield. They can't really run the football that well with Redding as they could the last couple years with Coleman and then Jordan Howard.
Devin Coleman on this team.
So they put Diamont in because they thought they could give him a spark, and it did. It kind of, you know, he had eight carries for 37 yards. Now, the problem is he can't throw the ball, but I'm beginning to think they should just do what Northwestern did with Coulter and Simeon, even if it's just totally obvious, you know, because they just need to be effective somehow offensively to let, I can't believe I'm going to say this, I hope lightning doesn't hit me, to let their defense win games. that might be an effective strategy, because the only, you know, I mean, because that did give them a little bit of a spark.
If you put Nate Sudfeld and Tevin Coleman on the team, this is a 10-win Indiana team. That's crazy.
Absolutely.
That's crazy. Let's move on to the most hilarious game of the week, Northwestern 54. 54! They scored 54. Seven. They scored seven against Illinois State. Big Ten!
I know.
Michigan State 40. Yeah. Clayton Thorson goes off 27 to 35, 281 yards, 8 yards an attempt, 3 touchdowns, 1 interception. Justin Jackson goes off 34 attempts, 188 yards, 5.5 yards a pop, 2 touchdowns.
What in the world of John L. Smith is going on?
I don't know, but I love it. It's amazing.
Yeah. Sometimes stats lie. At the end of the game, yards per play were 7.3 to 5.7 in favor of Michigan State, but they had a lot of big plays late. You know, and then Northwestern was obviously just pounding it into the line, just trying to, you know, close down a 2-touchdown win. But Northwestern was actually flirting with 7.7 yards per play through the first three quarters. And, Clayton Thorson, he came out on the first two drives of the second half and went 9 for 9 for 130 yards and led them to 2 touchdowns. And that pretty much took a 2-point lead, you know, up to a 16-point lead. And the Spartans were chasing the rest of the way.
Well, they opened up this game with like a pick six and a quick touchdown, so they're up 14-0. And then Northwestern just beats them down the rest of the way. And the one time Michigan State actually pulled within a score, they immediately returned the ensuing kickoff for a touchdown. And I went to a macaroni festival. It was like a tasting contest, and my wife's like, oh, I'm going to go to this thing, and I'm going to make this macaroni and cheese. And the room was just full of Spartan fans. And I'm not wearing any gear. I'm not saying anything. I'm just mutely watching the television as these guys just complain and complain and complain. And on the one hand, I wanted to be like, yeah, fist pump when Northwestern returns that kickoff for a touchdown. But on the other hand, it was wonderful.
That's a pretty solid bye week viewing experience for you.
It was, yeah. It was
You're like, oh, macaroni fest. Oh, great. It's full of despondent Michigan State fans.
Yeah, it was good. Michigan State started Brian Lewerke, who had a bunch of completions for no yards. And then they bring in Tyler O'Connor in the second half, who goes off because he throws two huge touchdowns to R.J. Shelton, one of which was a Roy Roundtree special where the Northwestern safety
very good comparison
deflects it to R.J. Shelton. So even that's a bit of fool's gold. They have a quarterback controversy.
Is that in Northwestern's defensive playbook?
I don't think so. Because why would you keep it in there after the Roundtree thing? I'd be like, all right, let's take this one out. Like, let's take the bat it to the other guys. And then Michigan State couldn't run the ball at all. They didn't even try, really. Like,
no, I mean, there's so many directions we can go, but you brought up the running. Lewerke was their leading rusher yesterday. He had their most carries and their most rushing yards, the quarterback who they benched at halftime.
That's just astounding.
I mean,
I mean, this is just an epic blowout, except for some extraordinary luck on Michigan State's part. And then they did get the big Shelton touchdown. But this is a 3-score win by a not very good Northwestern team. And, like, if Michigan State puts up 40 against Northwestern, they should be winning by 3 scores. Like, I mean, I know that they've kind of gotten off the schneid and they put up a bunch of points against Iowa, but like their offense is one thing. For their defense just to get gashed on the ground, like it's about time to pack it up for those guys.
Yeah, well, you know, they've got they really have nothing on the defensive line. You know, they've got Malik McDowell, but if not for him, you know, their guys on the interior were either playing at Nebraska last year or started the season on the offensive line depth chart for Michigan State. You know, they lost 5 defensive linemen off their roster since the playoff loss to Alabama. And, it's starting to show up.
It definitely is. I mean, they have a 6-year transfer from Nebraska, and like, if Nebraska thought he could play at all, he'd still be at Nebraska, right? Because there's so much.
Oh, totally. You know, he was Kenny Williams. He was actually a pretty solid recruit, but he didn't quite live up to that billing. Like you just said, if Nebraska thought he was worth having on the team, he wouldn't have been a graduate transfer.
Well, and they had a couple of guys, a couple of sacks in this game, but before this game, they're averaging one sack per game, which is just a bonkers number. So they have McDowell and they have nobody else on defense really, and like they're playing. I think you tweeted this out, right? Like that they're playing a redshirt freshman and a true freshman in their secondary, but Demetrius Cox is still out there.
Yeah, and the true freshman that they play in the secondary, Justin Lane, who had the pick six, he started the season higher on their wide receiver depth chart than he was on their defensive back depth chart, they've gone in with him. And all in with him, and then they took Copeland out for Josh Butler, the redshirt freshman. Yeah, they can't seem to find a replacement for Demetrius Cox, who just keeps getting lit up. They had him on Austin Carr yesterday for long stretches of the game. And, yeah, that did not work out. I mean, Austin Carr came in hot, too. He lit up Iowa last time Northwestern played. And, you know, I don't understand that. I don't understand the decision to keep playing him and also how they're playing him.
11 catches, 130 yards, 2 touchdowns for Austin Carr.
Woo.
Because Cox is just so bad. He really looks like a Rich Rod era Michigan defensive back. He's that bad. Northwestern they're up 10 points, right? And they've got like a fourth and short. And what do they decide to do? What's their best bet? It's to throw at Demetrius Cox into the end zone on a corner route, and they scored.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you know, and while we're talking about one reason why maybe they couldn't get him off the field yesterday was because, you know, Monte Nicholson, he left, and I don't think he came back into the game. So maybe they were forced to leave Cox because of that.
Well, I mean, they pulled him last year. I mean, they have, like, that Grayson Allen guy who played against Michigan last year. I don't know. And then compounding things for Michigan State is David Beadle came off the field with what looked like a pretty severe knee injury. So,
yeah,
obviously you don't like to see that, but it doesn't really help their case going forward.
No, you've talked, I think, at least twice in the last few weeks when we talked about Michigan State about just their shuffling on the offensive line. Yesterday was the fourth straight game where they've had a different starting offensive line combo. They've had 6 different guys start at guard alone in their last 4 games.
That sounds like Michigan 2013.
Yeah, well, and, you know, how about you, well, what set that up? No offensive line recruiting in, what, 2010?
Yep.
They only took 1 lineman, Michigan State did, in their 2013 class, and their 2014 lineman recruits are Miguel Machado, who's a junior college kid who's out after this year, Beadle, who, I mean, we'll see going forward on him after that injury, and Brian Allen, who they hit on, obviously, and the Clemens kid, who's now playing defensive line.
Yep, not great for them. Not great for them.
Yeah.
All right, finally this week, Ohio State 30, Wisconsin 23 in overtime. This was a defensive struggle for most of it, with Wisconsin's defense dominating the first half. The shocking thing to me is that Wisconsin ran the ball down Ohio State's throat using much the same techniques that Michigan is going to bring to Columbus in November. The Wisconsin running backs combined for 270 yards at 6.6 yards an attempt. They did have the one long run from Corey Clement, but this was a game where Wisconsin used the jet sweep effectively, and then once Ohio State started reacting to it, they pounded it inside. I mean, the Wisconsin offensive line was blowing the Ohio State DL off the ball.
Yeah. At one point in this game, Wisconsin was averaging 8 yards per play. They ended up with 6.1, but that was the best. You know, they played LSU, they played Michigan. That was the best they've looked all year, Wisconsin, I thought. And even without well, 2 things. That long run you referenced, one, that's their first run that long since Melvin Gordon left. They haven't had a run that long since the end of the 2014 season. But even if you take that run out, I think Clement still ended up with over 100 yards rushing. That's the best he's looked since he was Robin to Melvin Gordon's Batman.
Yeah, and I mean, it was just kind of a shock to me because I was going into this game expecting that Ohio State's defense was about as good as Michigan's defense, probably not quite as good, yeah. but in that department. And Michigan's defensive line just ate up Wisconsin. They couldn't get more than 2 yards on like 80% of their attempts. And in this game, Ohio State got formationed a lot, and they just couldn't hold up.
Yeah. They get after Michigan allowed Wisconsin just 2.5 yards per rush, Ohio State had 5.1, or Wisconsin, rather, went for 5.1 against Ohio State, 6.4 sacks adjusted.
That is highly, highly encouraging for the end of the year.
Yeah, and you know, and you mentioned Peavy. He had 2 runs against Michigan. He had a 17-yarder and a 16-yarder, but I honestly can't even remember those plays. But he had over 70 yards rushing against Ohio State, and he really jump-started some drives because there was a point, you know, where Ohio State's defense had sort of survived and they had steadied it, and then they came out in the second half and they really hit those plays well, those jet sweeps with Peavy pretty well. I like seeing those because obviously Michigan's got a couple different guys that they can run on those plays if they choose to do so.
Meanwhile, on the other side of the ball, JT Barrett runs 21 times, which is, I mean, they've been relying very heavily on his legs when they come up against good defenses. I mean, that's as many carries as both running backs got combined. And I mean, they did okay. Like, they got, you know, 4 yards a carry, maybe a little bit more than that. But Wisconsin kept them pretty much bottled up. And then Barrett in the second half was able to hit some deep shots against receivers that had broken open. Just things that I don't feel are going to happen against Michigan's corner crew.
Yeah, the second week in a row that JT has had more rushes than completions. And he kind of did get hot. He got hot there in the second half. But I also thought it was interesting that it literally rained for one play in the game.
Yeah.
And on that play, he threw just a terrible pick to a wide-open Wisconsin defensive back on a scoring drive. That interception was in the end zone.
It was.
Yeah. But Weber and Samuel had 23 carries combined for 92 yards. They were definitely
bottled up. Yeah. And the thing about, you know, watching this game is that, you know, we played Wisconsin. I know that they have one very good defensive lineman, Connor Sheehy, but their nose tackle isn't great. Their other defensive end isn't great. He's a decent pass rusher. Their linebackers really, you know, brought a lot of freight. But if this Wisconsin defense can bottle up the Ohio State run game, I have to feel that Michigan's absolutely rampant defensive line is going to do well.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even though Ohio State ended up coming back to win, the whole game just gave off a whole lot of good feelings about how Michigan might perform next month against Ohio State. You know, I just thought it was so unique that to such an opportunity to kind of compare apples and apples. And I was pretty excited throughout the game. It seemed like almost every series there was something that you could look at and say, hey, that's something Michigan should be able to do. You know, you're talking about the defensive line. Wisconsin had, or not just the defensive line, but just the whole concept of winning the defensive front versus offensive front. Wisconsin had 7 tackles for loss against Ohio State. Ohio State only had given up 9 for the season. So, you know, I look at that as like, well, they're finally playing a team that can bring some havoc. And, you know, the Badgers can only bring havoc at that linebacker, unit. You know, you mentioned up front, you know, they don't have much as far as defensive linemen. You know, Michigan is just across the board; they just have more players. So I mean, I looked at Wisconsin getting 7 TFLs last night as a huge point of optimism.
Well, and if you just look at total yards, Wisconsin 450 to Ohio State's 411, and Michigan outgained by Wisconsin by 200 yards. So all the peripherals in this game point to Michigan being a better team than Ohio State. And I'm not saying that's true, but I'm saying I feel a lot better about that ending date in Columbus after watching this game.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. It just Wisconsin just didn't have any sustained drives against Michigan. Against Michigan, they averaged 4 plays per possession. Against Ohio State, they averaged 6.5 plays per possession. against Michigan, Wisconsin averaged 12.3 yards per drive. Against Ohio State, they averaged 38.6 yards per drive. Crazy.
Yep. All right. And, that's hope, man.
Total. And this is, you know, I want to throw this in here, too, in case nobody reads the Pro Football Focus breakdown of the game. Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I'm still lost at their new scoring system. But when I read through their breakdown before I came on the podcast, the one thing that struck me was the Wisconsin running backs against Michigan only gained 0.55 yards per rush before contact. That's a mouthful, I know. But against Ohio State last night, they gained 1.57 yards per rush before contact.
Big difference.
Yeah. Big difference.
All right. We've already had a very long podcast, so we're going to have to let you go, Jamie.
Not a problem. Can I throw one quick number out there before we leave?
Yeah.
It's actually going to be two, but it's going to be very quick. One, the combined record of Michigan State and Notre Dame, if you throw their game out against each other, is 3-8, and their wins were against Furman, Nevada, and Syracuse.
I like this.
Yes, and you'll like this one too. Michigan State has as many losses as the other four FBS schools in the state of Michigan,
including Eastern.
Eastern Michigan is 5-2.
They're 5-2,
headed for a bowl game.
Wonders will never cease.
Yeah, whoever the Eastern coach is, he's going to look really good in Purdue Golden Black.
Oh, Big Ten. All right, Jamie, thanks for calling.
Right,
we'll talk to you next week. Thank you for listening to the MGo podcast. Ace usually does this bit, but he's watching Pitch Perfect 2 over and over again today. I'd like to thank Larry Deitch for coming on and being a very, very educated regent at us. Thanks to Jamie for coming on as well. And don't forget, Rutgers scored a touchdown. Northwestern 54. They scored 7. They scored 7 against Illinois State.
What in the world of John L. Smith is going on?
I don't know, but I love it.